I guess it's time to get... Is this working at all? I'm not hearing anything. I guess it's time to get started. This is session 262. Is the Afghanistan War Just? A Book of Mormon Approach. And this session is sponsored by the Mormon Worker. And before I do the introductions, I just want to turn a few minutes over to Jason Brown to make a quick announcement.
Hey everybody, I'm Jason Brown. Is it working?
No. Hey Tristan, can you ask one of them out?
It disappears into the floor. I don't know what to do. So I'll just speak loudly at first and hopefully we can get it fixed. There we go.
There we go.
What'd you do?
Push the button.
Okay, just really quickly before we get started, I'm Jason Brown with the Mormon Worker, and I wanted to remind you all that we have a session tomorrow at 11:15 on Mormonism and Radical Politics. We'd love to see you all come out to that. There's also free copies of the paper in the back. Please stop by our booth. We're trying to raise money to pay for the cost of printing the Mormon Worker, so anything you could donate would really help. We're also having a potluck, kind of get to know you, Mormon Worker gathering on Saturday night at 7 p.m. at Tyler Bushman's house. We have flyers in the back and at the table. Thank you.
Well.
You did that.
You got another button you can push there. We have a mic now. There we go. Well, I'm guessing that the Mormon Worker is getting used to pushing buttons. That was meant as a joke.
This is a big ball.
I'm getting old. I can't read without lines. The other part of the ballroom's got the lights off.
And we got them on, so we're going back and forth.
Uh-huh. Do you want to switch or something? There,
right. I'll bring my phone over. So, as I was saying earlier, this session is the Afghanistan War Just? A Book of Mormon Approach. First, we'll hear from William Van Wagner. Will received his undergraduate degree in German from Brigham Young University, a master's degree in theological studies from Harvard. He worked in Iraq for 7 months for a small human rights organization in 2005-2006. He's a regular contributor to the Mormon Worker, a journal devoted to Mormonism and radical politics. Second, we'll hear from Josh Madsen. Joshua Madsen received his undergraduate degree in history from Brigham Young University, and a law degree from the J. Reuben Clark Law School. He's an attorney practicing in Alpine, Utah, an editor and contributor for the Mormon Worker. Please welcome Will.
All right, again, everyone can't hear. I assume I'm speaking loud enough, but the reason that Josh and I wanted to give this particular presentation was because last spring there was a symposium at BYU, a BYU Studies Symposium, and a number of different speakers talked on the subject of Mormonism and war. And there was one BYU professor named Kenneth Alford, who's a member of the military himself and teaches at BYU, used to teach at West Point, who gave a presentation and, you know, basically stated a couple times that the war in Afghanistan was a just war. His presentation wasn't about that, so he didn't give reasons why he thought that, so I can only speculate as to what his reasons are, but they probably, you know, kind of coincide with the general reasons that the U.S. government might give as to why we need to be fighting in Afghanistan. But anyway, so we decided just to give this presentation as kind of a response to that, and then, you know, I'll finish writing this up and put it in the Mormon Worker and send a copy over to to Professor Alford, hopefully. So I can see fine. I mean, so the question is, as Mormons, we should evaluate whether things are right or wrong, not exclusively, but largely based on things that we learn in the Book of Mormon. And there's a lot of information in the Book of Mormon that about violence and about war. And there are some guidelines that are pretty clear in the Book of Mormon about when it's okay to fight and when it's not okay to fight. And so just, you guys probably know all of the passages that would relate to this type of stuff, so I won't go into too much detail. But basically in the Book of Mormon, it's pretty clear that if you fight a war in self-defense, you're pretty much justified. And if you fight a war of offense or a war of aggression, then that's condemned. And examples of that are the Lamanites are continually invading Nephite lands, and so people like Captain Moroni or the Prophet Mormon are always trying to encourage the Nephites to repel the Lamanite invasions and fight for their homes and wives and families and religion and things like that. And there's a couple places where it's pretty clearly condemned when the Nephites go on the offensive. Here's just one passage that kind of states what the Nephite, kind of attitude towards war was. This is in Alma 43:46, where it says, "For the Lord had said unto them, and also unto their fathers, that inasmuch as ye are not guilty of the first offense, neither the second, ye shall not suffer yourselves to be slain by the hands of your enemies." So again, fight in self-defense, that's it. One story that people often look to in the Book of Mormon regarding violence is the story of the people of Ammon or the Ammonites. And there's kind of a misconception that the Ammonites were pacifists because, of course, they make the covenant to lay down their weapons of war and they allow themselves to be slaughtered by the Lamanites rather than actually fight. But they weren't strict pacifists. They say that the reason that they made the covenant to not fight anymore is because they considered themselves murderers. They participated with the Lamanite armies in wars of aggression against the Nephites, and they considered that murder. And so once they converted, they realized, that that was wrong. That the things they had done to kill all those people had been wrong, had been murder. So they say, because of what we've done, we're going to make this like covenant with God and lay down our weapons. Later, they end up having their sons fight on their behalf and on behalf of the Nephites, and they almost are even on the verge of breaking the covenant and going to fight again against the Lamanites when there's a subsequent Lamanite invasion. But Helaman has to convince them, no, go ahead and keep your covenant. We'll fight on your behalf. So if they were strict pacifists, they would have like told their sons, hey, don't go to war, and we're not going to support the war effort and things like that. So that's not to say that there's no argument for pacifism in the Book of Mormon. Josh is going to cover that, so I'll leave that question for him. But at the very least, in the Book of Mormon, defensive war is what is allowed. So moving on to Afghanistan, is the war... Oh, actually, one more quick thing. The one problem with defensive war is you have to take government propaganda into account. Almost every time the government says, hey, we need to go to war, whatever the reason, they always say, oh, this is in self-defense. Even, Hitler made the famous comment that Czechoslovakia is a dagger pointed at the heart of Germany. If you look on a map of Germany and Czechoslovakia, it's kind of Czechoslovakia kind of looks that way on a map. So every government is always going to try and couch things in defensive terms, even though they're not. Ronald Reagan also said that, warned that Nicaragua is 2 days' drive from Texas, implying in the 80s that the poor country of Nicaragua would somehow be able to invade the United States if the U.S. didn't go to war against the socialist Sandinista government. And so these statements, of course, are ridiculous, but at the time, people were like, oh, yeah, we better go kill those people. So this is a problem, and you find that actually in the Book of Mormon as well, and you find that in the story of Zenith and in the story of Amalickiah. Amalickiah was a Lamanite king who incites or stirs up the hearts of the Lamanites to go to war against the Nephites for no good reason, builds these towers and has his representatives get up in the towers and speak to the Lamanites to incite them to go to war. And then you also see that in the story of Zenith, where he goes among the Lamanites as a spy on behalf of the Nephites to check out the strength of their armies and to, you know, see, get information so that the Nephites could destroy the Lamanite armies. But when Zenith lives among the Lamanites as a spy, he realizes that, hey, the Lamanites are pretty good people. And he goes back to the Nephite king and says, I don't think we should destroy them. I think we should make a peace treaty with them. And so the king doesn't like that, so he tries to have Zenith executed. And so Zenith starts an armed rebellion against the Nephite king, which is kind of similar to a lot of the U.S. servicemen in Vietnam who refused orders to fight against the Viet Cong and North Vietnamese. And some of them, in fact, even killed some of their senior officers, what's referred to as fragging, because they knew that what they were doing was wrong. And so they said, well, instead of going to kill Vietnamese who really aren't our enemies, we'd rather kill our commanding officers. So that's basically what Zen did. So that, you have to beware of propaganda. So at any rate, moving on to the Afghanistan War, we have to see the Afghanistan War as a part of the broader war on terror. After 9/11, the Bush administration was very quick to say, hey, we're not going to focus specifically on Al-Qaeda. This is a broader effort that's going to strike against many targets in many different places. And let me just read a couple quick quotes. For example, Douglas Feith, who was the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy during the Bush administration, explained that, quote, in order to counter this threat successfully of terrorism, we could not rely on a defensive strategy alone. These considerations necessitated a strategy of initiative and offense of disrupting the terrorist network abroad. In addition, Donald Rumsfeld, who was Secretary of Defense, wrote a document called the Strategic Guidance for the Defense Department. This is just a couple weeks after 9/11. Which established the official military objective of going to war against not just the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, who you would expect, but also to go against Iraq, Iran, Syria, Libya, Sudan, and Somalia as well. So from the very beginning, there was a plan not only to get the people who actually committed the attacks against the United States, but to invade in an offensive manner Iraq, Iran, Syria, etc. Again, Rumsfeld noted in a memo after 9/11 that, quote, the president has stressed that we are not defining our fight narrowly and are not focused only on those directly responsible for the September 11th attacks. And that's one reason why, again, Rumsfeld supported an invasion against Iraq. They discussed invading Iraq literally the same day that 9/11 happened, after the attacks, and the Bush administration had been planning to invade Iraq, even quite a bit before 9/11. And that was really disturbing to some other members of the administration. Why would you go against Iraq when it's, Al-Qaeda that attacked us? So, to be clear, there was no threat from Iraq against the United States. That's kind of a side topic that I won't go into, but that was clearly an offensive war against Iraq. Killed hundreds of thousands of Iraqis. Some estimates are as high as a million. Really devastated their economy, pushed more people even then were in poverty in Iraq before the war, into poverty, raised unemployment, destroyed the healthcare sector. There's no basic services. Like, it's really hard to get clean drinking water and electricity, all those things. The war in Iraq has really been a disaster and a tragedy for the Iraqi people, even though Iraq was no threat to us. So, but moving on to Afghanistan, well, if Iraq was an offensive war, the Afghanistan war seems like maybe it was more defensive. Hey, Al-Qaeda attacked us, and they were based out of Afghanistan, so the Taliban must be responsible, which is what President Bush argued by saying, quote, by aiding and abetting murder, the Taliban regime is committing murder. So that's actually not really true. Osama bin Laden was in Afghanistan before the Taliban took power, so they kind of inherited the problem of Osama bin Laden's presence. And Osama bin Laden did help them in their war against other different ethnic groups and tribes in Afghanistan that they were trying to take control of the government from. But ever since about 1998, because of some of the things that Osama bin Laden was doing, like bombing embassies and things like that, the Taliban had two conditions for him in order for him to stay in the country. The first was that he could not use Afghanistan as a base for attacks against any other country. And secondly, that he couldn't speak to any international or foreign media. There was a couple times they took his satellite phones away. They replaced his Arab contingent of guards with the Taliban contingent so they could keep a closer eye on him. And it's now, you know, in retrospect, apparent from, you know, a number of different sources that they, you know, were trying to keep a lid on bin Laden. And there was a couple times that they were really, really close to actually giving him up to the United States. The reasons why those deals didn't go through are a little bit murky. But they were very, very close on a number of occasions to giving up bin Laden because they saw him as a problem for them. So after 9/11, the Taliban were really angry at bin Laden because obviously he brought the wrath of the United States down upon them unnecessarily. And so they really were upset with what he did. So they didn't facilitate the attacks on 9/11. That was something that bin Laden and al-Qaeda did. So right there, it makes you feel like, well, that's not really defensive war if the Taliban really wasn't responsible. And so right after 9/11, there were additional attempts by the Taliban to give up bin Laden. President Bush basically demanded, give him up to us, no negotiations, no conditions, give him up to us immediately. And the Taliban basically said, well, you just need to give us some evidence that he was implicated in the attacks, and then we'll deliver him up probably to a third country like Pakistan or Saudi Arabia. Now, the Bush administration says, well, look, they're not serious about giving up bin Laden. They're just trying to protect him. They're just delaying and things like that. But the Taliban, they needed a way to save face. They're a Muslim government. That's their whole legitimacy is based on the idea that they promote the interests of Muslims and are enforcing Sharia law and things like this in Afghanistan. So just to give up a fellow Muslim to the infidel United States, who the United States had already committed many, many, many crimes and atrocities against Muslims in the Middle East, for example, in Iraq in the 1991 Gulf War and the subsequent sanctions, supporting Israel in their invasions of Lebanon and oppression and ethnic cleansing of the Palestinians. So to just go ahead and give up bin Laden without any like real good pretext was politically difficult for them. So there was a CIA officer named Milton Bearden who, you know, contends that the Taliban really wanted to give up bin Laden, but they needed the U.S. to kind of help them do it. Like, hey, just give us some evidence, you know, so we can, this will seem more legitimate to our constituency and we'll give him up. But the Bush administration immediately said no, rejected the offer, and then started bombing Afghanistan. And then after the bombing of Afghanistan started, the Taliban submitted another offer saying, okay, we won't even demand any evidence, but we'll hand him over to a third-party country, you know, if you guys are willing to stop the bombing. And the Bush administration rejected that offer as well and just said, nope, we're going to keep bombing. So then the question is, why was the Bush administration so intent on going to war against Afghanistan? Why would they want a war? I mean, most sensible people would try to avoid a war. And obviously, based on the Book of Mormon framework, only defensive wars are allowed if you can avoid a war. You know, that's the right thing to do, right? And the reason, in my view, is a quote, again, from Douglas Feith, who is the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, where he said, quote, one way to disrupt terrorist groups was to compel their state sponsors to change policies on terrorism and on weapons of mass destruction. This could be done, we reasoned, through military action against some of the state sponsors and pressure, short of war, against the others. The effectiveness of the diplomatic pressure would hinge to some extent on the success of our military actions.
You know what? You were supposed to do the other Book of Mormon stuff.
All right, we'll get to it.
I'm sorry, I just got going. We were supposed to switch up.
Now, what time is it, by the way, so I don't go too far?
3:53.
3:53? Okay.
So what that quote basically says, it goes back to this idea that Rumsfeld had, which is we're going to invade Afghanistan, we're going to invade Iraq, we're going to invade Iran. And if we can invade a couple of these countries, two or three of them, we'll make an example out of them that these other countries, like Syria, Sudan, Somalia, etc., Libya, will see and say, oh, we don't want to turn out like the Taliban and like Saddam Hussein, or Afghanistan, Iraq, whose countries were attacked, so we better like change our foreign policy and do what the United States says. So this is what Douglas Feith is talking about. This could be done through military action against some of the state sponsors and pressure short of war against others. The effectiveness of the diplomatic pressure would hinge to some extent on the success of our military actions. So if you're really successful in destroying Afghanistan and destroying Iraq, everyone else is going to be so scared that they'll do what you say. So it was not in the United States' interest, based on their strategy, for the Taliban to give up bin Laden, because then the rationale that they gave publicly to people would have just fallen apart. If suddenly we had Osama bin Laden, he was getting tried in an international court, why would the American public continue to support a war against Afghanistan if the perpetrators of the 9/11 attacks was, you know, being tried and being brought to justice? So the U.S. just rejected offers by the Taliban, said, nope, we're just going to keep bombing, we're going to continue with the war, because that was part of their plan to start this offensive war against multiple different countries. Even though that doesn't conform with Book of Mormon guidelines, let me just explain from just more pragmatic reasons why it was a bad policy to do what they did. When they said, hey, we're going to involve the Taliban and attack the Taliban and consider them responsible for 9/11, basically what they did was increase the number of enemies that they had. The Taliban is largely drawn from an ethnicity called the Pashtuns in Afghanistan. And the Afghan warlords that the U.S. allied themselves with and actually used to do most of the fighting were from two different ethnic groups, the Tajiks and the Uzbeks. And so by declaring war on the Taliban and attacking the Taliban, they basically turned the war not into just a war against the Taliban government, but into a war against Pashtun nationalism. So let me give you a couple quick quotes. And I know I got to finish up quick here. Sorry, Josh. For example, an Afghan who is the president of the Regional Studies Center of Afghanistan warned that, unfortunately, if the situation goes on like now, 10 years later you will fight against maybe 1 million fundamentalists, people like the Taliban, because it is clear that when you kill one innocent person among Pashtuns, 10 more Taliban will rise. And so again, the more people you kill from that particular ethnicity, you get more enemies. In addition, just the more people you kill generally, their family members aren't happy about that, and so they'll want to fight against you as well. So for example, there is another Afghan who's an editor of an Afghan newspaper who said, so if a man is living in the countryside, seeing civilians killed by foreign soldiers and losing members of his family, why would he be happy for them to stay? And this is borne out of the fact that, you know, when you attack innocent civilians, which is inevitable in a war against a government or against a country, that's going to generate more resistance and more enemies for you. This is borne out by a statistical study that was conducted by economists from Princeton and Stanford universities here in the United States. And they found that in Afghanistan, quote, we find strong evidence for a revenge effect in that local exposure to NATO and U.S.-generated civilian casualties drives increased insurgent violence over the long run. Matching districts with similar past trends in violence shows that counterinsurgent-generated civilian casualties, like bombing a wedding or a house raid where you kill kids or women, shooting people at checkpoints, it says these civilian casualties drive. Again, matching districts with similar past trends in violence show that counterinsurgent-generated civilian casualties of the kind I described from a typical incident are responsible for 6 additional violent incidents in an average-sized district in the following 6 weeks. A couple quick quotes. General Stanley McChrystal said that, quote, we have shot an amazing number of people at checkpoints, but to my knowledge, none has ever proven to be a threat. On March 26, 2010, there was a night raid carried out by U.S. and Afghan gunmen where they shot and killed 2 pregnant women, a teenage girl, and 2 local police officers. NATO then claimed that the Taliban had brutally, murdered these pregnant women. And then, of course, after the Afghan government investigated it, the U.S. had to recant the story and acknowledge that, okay, our guys really did kill these pregnant women. There's an incident where NATO and U.S. troops stormed a house where they killed 10 children and teenagers in a remote mountain compound near the border with Pakistan. That was in February of 2010. NATO claimed that they were targeting known insurgents, but they turned out to be all civilians. And then the issue of airstrikes, where again, a lot of people get killed with airstrikes. In fact, there's airstrikes today where 12 NATO or Afghan civilians were killed. But here's an incident, quote, 2 dozen children are said to be among the dead after U.S. warplanes reportedly bombed a wedding party in Afghanistan. U.S. military officials said the incident, in which up to 40 civilians were reportedly killed and the bride wounded, was being investigated. The party was taking place close to where Taliban militants took cover. There was another wedding where another 45 women and children were killed, including the bride. And there's a lot of stories like this that just never, you know, get out in the press. So even since then, in 2009, the Taliban offered to give the U.S. legal guarantees that they would not allow their territory to be used for any attacks against other countries in exchange for the withdrawal of foreign troops. And once again, the United States rejected the offer. You know, their preference, or the preference of not only the Bush administration, but also the Obama administration, is to just continue the war and keep it going. So.
All right. What I'm going to do is a little different than what Will did. I may make some comments about the Afghanistan war just throughout, just for time's sake. But what I want to do is look at the Book of Mormon. At this symposium that Will mentioned, one of the critiques was specifically as to Hugh Nibley, and that his pacifist, nonviolent reading of the Book of Mormon was in error. And so I want to address that and give my sort of nonviolent reading of the Book of Mormon, and give sort of a way of reading it. So looking at the macro view of the Book of Mormon, there's different ways to read it. There's the characters. I could read, for example, what Alma says or Captain Moroni says and take that as truth on face value. I can also do what Grant Hardy's done in his recent book, Understanding the Book of Mormon, and look at the narrator. You know, why does Nephi write the small plates of Nephi the way he does? Is he trying to justify his position, explain things? And it gives us an insight into why he wrote it the way he did. The same thing with Mormon. Why did Mormon write his abridgment the way he did? And then there's another sort of step back where as a reader slash historian, we can look at it and have insights that maybe Mormon and Nephi didn't have by looking at the whole picture. And so when I step back and look at the Book of Mormon as a whole, I would say it's a formula for failure, not success. And that it obviously is a tragedy and not a success story. When we look at it, we see the results are the destruction of an entire civilization, at least one of them. And the lesson I learned is to be wiser. And so there's obviously positive aspects throughout it, but on a whole, when I look at the macro, I see it as a failure. Now I'm going to go through sort of my macro view. It begins, and I'm going to touch on these, with Nephi and his brothers, his group, Nephite's group, and those that follow him. Start with what I would call a founding murder when he murders Laban. And the sword of Laban becomes a model for kingship, for Nephite kingship. In fact, they model other swords on it. We look at many wars between the Lamanites and Nephites, but we notice that in all these wars, there's never a lasting peace afterwards. The Lamanites continually return on the attack, and there continues to be violence and chaos and war. And then the only instances we really find lasting peace in the Book of Mormon are through missionary work or dialogue. And in fact, when this happens, in one case, we can see where the Lamanites, well, actually more than one case, give up war entirely, but in one case, hand land back to the Nephites and say, here's your land. We also see, for example, in 3 Nephi 9, when Jesus appears in the text, that he denounced all forms of sacrificial violence, including war, and he actually references these Lamanites as the example that we should follow. And so he appears and he does the same thing he did in the sort of Palestine, and that in the New Testament, he intensifies the Torah. He goes from eye for an eye, which is, you know, limiting violence. You know, it's interesting to look at the way we wage war today. There's no proportionality. We get our eye poked out and we kill the whole person. We go way beyond that. But the eye for eye was actually much more progressive in terms of renouncing violence than we are even today. But he intensified that beyond that to love your enemies. So we see that in the Book of Mormon. And then we see peace break out for 200 years. And then it falls into chaos again, one eternal round of bloodshed and violence, and it ends. And so I'm going to touch a couple of things. So when we look at the small plaints of Nephi, we have what I call a foundational murder. By foundational, I mean the support, the body, the thing that it's built upon. So Nephi killing Laban. Even if we were to argue that that's justified, there's a lot of unintended consequences that spill out of that. I particularly, personally, take more of a Girardian view from Rene Girard. and would argue that culture derives from scapegoating. We are psychosocially constituted and therefore trapped by the lie of a sacred violence. We think in sacrificial terms, much like Nephi. Better that one person should die than a nation should perish. We unconsciously sanctify our violence as divine in origin, necessary for redemption. We therefore have great difficulty recognizing the truth of our own violence and its foundational role in culture. And so there's interesting things, obviously, when, you know, Kent Brown's pointed out, Grant Harding's book as well, when Nephi returns from killing Laban, there's a strange admission. His father, Lehi, doesn't make any comments about it whatsoever. He didn't say, good job, son, or, you know, you did a bad job. Nephi leaves that out. And they offer sacrifice for sin, as Kent Brown calls it. But what are the lessons to be learned? Nephi takes the sword of Laban, the very sword that he killed him with, and this object represents, in my mind, a foundational murder in anthropological terms. And it becomes the representative of kingship and the head of the nation. The scriptures we read that he passes it on generationally to each new king in the Nephite Empire. We read in the scriptures that Nephi wields the sword in war. King Benjamin uses it in war. And in fact, all of the Nephite swords, the text tells us, are based upon this original sword. And so this original killing of Laban reverberates throughout Nephite culture. And the questions I ask myself when I look at it, how does the choice of a sword taken from a drunk man, used to cut off his head, and then rob his place, define a nation? How does that sword define a nation? How does that affect their ideas of how they react with their enemies? Because it's interesting, this sword seems to be this representative that goes throughout Nephite culture. And so early on in the Book of Mormon, we see the same thing in the Old Testament, enemy brothers. Nephite's at war with his two brothers, just as Jacob and Esau were at war, Joseph and his brothers were at war. But unlike the texts that we read in the Old Testament, where Jacob and Esau, one of the most touching accounts in my opinion, they find at woman and break down the barrier between the two of them, or with Joseph and his brothers, where they break down that barrier again and find at woman, this doesn't happen in the Book of Mormon. So in the Book of Mormon, what we have is a conflict between two brothers, or three, I guess, which, unlike that between Jacob and Esau, doesn't end in reconciliation at woman, but instead is a full-blown dynastic conflict ending in the entire destruction of a people. And so from that very beginning of the Book of Mormon, we see the beginning of this failure, of their inability to reconcile among those brothers. So real quick, looking at Mormon's narration in his text, I find it interesting that Mormon never speaks of war figuratively. He doesn't make it a metaphor for Christian living. In fact, when he gets to his eventual conclusion, which is Mormon 7, the last thing he writes, he's probably in his 70s by now, based on the text that we can gather. He says that we should lay down our weapons of war and delight no more in the shedding of blood. And I have to wonder whether he had a McNamara-type moment. You know, he went through all this chaos since he was a young man. He saw the bloodshed. He saw his people die. And he realized, you know, maybe nothing good can come of this. And perhaps, you know, as his concluding statement on the Book of Mormon, we could, maybe that's part of the reason why he gave us what he gave us. So, you know, in discussing the Afghanistan War, the way I thought about it is an overview. How do we respond to our enemies? I think Nibley classically said you can destroy them or you can convert them. Whether it's necessarily converting them or converting ourselves as well, it's an issue of changing the narrative. In the same way that Nephi composed his small plates of Nephi that told one narrative about why he was chosen, why his brothers were wicked, and why they were evil, and this sort of story was passed on to his descendants, the Lamanites had the same thing. They had stories. They had a narrative as well. And it fed into their hatred of one another. So these two options that we're presented with in the Book of Mormon are war and dialogue or missionary work. And so when we look at the wars and conflicts in the Book of Mormon, from a nonviolent reading perspective of mine, it's not black and white. It's not clear that the Lamanites are always at fault. In fact, almost all the major wars occur because wicked Nephites actually go in among the Lamanites and compel them to attack the Nephites. So these wars are just as much a Nephite problem as they are a Lamanite problem. So it's not a black and white issue. So one quick case study is Nehor. Nehor is, of course, a horrible individual in the Book of Mormon. And I have no doubt he appears to, at least from what I can gather from the text, to be someone who was interested in gathering money, and he obviously was a murderer. He killed someone. But how do we get to these eventual wars that we find with Captain Moroni? Well, Nehor, he teaches a doctrine that's considered perverse, and even worse, he murders Gideon. So the Nephite solution is, let's kill Nehor. So here, like the founding of Nephite civilization with the killing of Laban and that sword being passed down and reverberating throughout their culture, we have another act of violence where they kill Nehor. Now, what happens afterwards? Well, the divisions that were created by Nehor's sect in fact, deep in after his execution. And they lead to his followers violently persecuting the Church of God. These divisions are later used by Amalaki, or Amlici, I'm not sure how it's pronounced, to gain power and force a popular election to anoint himself king. He fails in that, and he's not elected king, but instead what he does, he goes, allies himself with the Lamanites and convinces them to start a war. And so they join with the Amalekites, the Zoramites, and renegade Nephites in an effort to destroy the Nephites. So here's how the war starts. It starts, and I have to wonder, you know, Alma says, we got to kill Gideon, because if we don't kill him, his blood will come in vengeance upon us. And yet in the very act of killing him, it seems like there's this vengeance coming upon them as well. Because the followers of Nehor eventually are the ones that compel the Lamanites to attack. Another group of Nehor adherents afterwards, we learn, actually throw people into the fire, women and children, who believe in the words of Alma and Amalek. And so there's some real serious consequences from this man Nehor. And I have to wonder if them killing him and choosing to deal with their enemy in that way is part of the reason why these things occur. So, real quickly, the Lamanite view, we get this briefly from Zenith. We also get it from a letter to Captain Moroni. And basically, their perspective, contrary to the Nephite perspective, is that, you know, from the very beginning, we were wronged. Nephi stole our birthright. He wronged us when we were on the ship, they say. He wronged us by taking the scriptures. He wronged us by trying to put himself as the ruler. And so they go through this litany of their traditions. So the Lamanites have a narrative as well. And in their narrative, they are justified in what they do. They see themselves as the ones who were wrong. They see themselves as the ones that were afflicted by Nephi. Just as Nephi has his own narrative where he sees the opposite. That in fact his brothers who tried to kill him. And it was Laman and Lemuel that did those evils to him. So what we have are these two competing narratives. And so we keep seeing these wars occurring in the Book of Mormon. And it's interesting that the big war that we always see in the Book of Mormon is Captain Moroni. When he eventually ends the war, it's only a matter of 8-9 years afterwards till it breaks out again. And what I'd like to suggest is when you look at the Book of Mormon, whether it's in early on in the small plates of Nephi, we see the Lamanites coming again and again and again, and the war continues again and again and again, they never find peace. Or whether it's with Captain Moroni, who wages this huge warfare, they get quote-unquote peace, only lasts for, you know, 8 years. That warfare, at least as presented in the Book of Mormon, never results in a lasting peace. And in fact, the only thing we're ever presented in the Book of Mormon that gives us any possibility of peace is an alternate view. It's the one we see with the sons of Mosiah. It's the one we see with Nephi and Lehi. The sons of Mosiah decided we would go unto the Lamanites. And they decided that it wasn't enough just to preach Christ, but they actually had to engage their narrative and their story. In their words, they said, we need to cure them of their hatred towards the Nephites, that they might become friendly to one another and there should be no more contentions in the land. So from their perspective, they decided to take a major break with what Nephites have been doing. And instead of killing their enemies and engaging in violent conflict, they decided, we'll try to have dialogue with our enemies, present our side of the story, try to find some sort of peace. And so for them, it was a matter of having the correct narrative, the correct story, the dialogue. It didn't work out perfectly. You know, obviously the anti-Nephi Lehites were converted, but it was a model. And it was a model that was later followed by Lehi and Helaman. And so what I want to propose is, you know, with the Afghanistan war, when we think about it, I think it's been shown in numerous cases that when we engage violently with our enemies, it has what's called blowback, in the sense that, you know, these children are growing up, other individuals are being turned off, and hatred for the U.S. or hatred for whoever the occupying power becomes much stronger, and so the conflict continues. And it seems to me that the Book of Mormon presents the same situation, where no matter how justified the Nephites may have been in quote-unquote defensive war, as Will described it, in defending their homes and lands, it never solved the real problem. It was hacking at the branches and not the root of the tree. Because the real root of the problem was the hatred the Lamanites had and the hatred the Nephites had towards the Lamanites. And the only way that could be solved was literally changing the hearts and minds of those people. And so in our modern conflicts, if I apply the Book of Mormon to them as well, I have to consider whether or not we are simply engaging in violence that's going to break out again and again and again until truly people's hearts and minds are changed. Paul talks about the atonement in Ephesians. And it's an interesting scripture because in it, it's not just about personal piety or sanctity. is which is how a lot of times we look at atonement. You know, there's a barrier between me and God, and we call it sin. He actually says that this barrier is something different. It's a historical fact of separate stories. It is not a barrier of guilt, but of culture and communication. It is not a barrier between each person and God, but between one group and another. It is not the case that inner or personal peace comes first, with the hope that once the inward condition is set right, then the restored person will do some social good. In his text, it is the other way around. Two estranged histories are made into one. Two hostile communities are reconciled. And so for me, when I see the atonement or at-one-ment, whether it's with Jacob and Esau, Joseph and his brothers, or this breach that occurred between the Lamanites and Nephites, there has to be a breach of these two histories, these two stories, these two hostile communities, if there's going to be any lasting peace. And in the Book of Mormon, when this is attempted, what do we find? We find in almost every case the Lamanites bury their weapons of war. They do it with anti-Nephite Lehites. In Helaman 5:6, they do it again. Samuel the Lamanite later comments on it that this is a characteristic of Lamanites. Whenever they're presented with the truth, they bury their weapons of war. And they don't take them up anymore. In fact, in Helaman 5:6, it's so remarkable that not only do they bury their weapons of war, they give all the land back in a great effort of peace and restoration. And so, again, Jesus, when he shows up in 3 Nephi 9, I find these words interesting. He says that, you know, there should be no more sacrifices, no more shedding of blood. And in fact, he specifically references this sacrifice of a broken heart and contrite spirit to the Lamanites, who are baptized with fire. And so it seems to me that in this text he's suggesting that the broken heart and contrite spirit is part and parcel with what occurred with the Lamanites, and them renouncing war entirely and laying down their weapons of war. So, to me, when I look at the Book of Mormon as on a macro level and look at the wars, yes, I can find justification. I can say, yes, Captain Moroni and them say that there's defensive war, and yes, we're justified in defending our homes, families, etc. But when I look at the macro level, what does that really accomplish? Because in the end, that never solved any of their problems, because there kept being a new war, new violence breaking out with each next generation. I don't know whether that was because of their children that were left fatherless, or because of the horrors and atrocities of war that made people want to turn, much like Will cited some of the Taliban and the people in Afghanistan that felt like they needed to push back against the U.S. now. So I'm going to quote Richard Bushman here, because I like his conclusion in an article that I came across recently. He said, "The story of the Book of Mormon speaks to all who face implacable enemies, ones who are committed to aggressive incursions on peaceful peoples. The Book of Mormon tells us why we may indeed have to defend ourselves with force in the face of an enemy onslaught. But it just as clearly states that militant defense will not end wars. Aggressive people, when meeting resistance, will come back generation after generation, century after century, even though soundly defeated time after time. Force, however benevolently intended, will not stop force permanently. As Christ said, he who lives by the sword dies by the sword. Violence begets violence. In national as in personal affairs, kindness, truth, and service are the only avenues of lasting peace." So from my macro perspective, when I read the Book of Mormon, again, I see it as a failure. And I see the real success with those who break with the war and the violence and trying to do something new, trying to actually engage their enemies in dialogue and turning the other cheek and trying to actually change their hearts and minds to find some kind of lasting peace. In conclusion, I'm going to read this quote. "The gospel confronts every person with fundamental questions. Will I continue to sacrifice my fellow humans for my own benefit, or am I willing to sacrifice myself for their benefit? Will I continue to follow the sacrificial economy of Satan, or will I imitate Christ in his voluntary self-giving for others? Will I construct my identity through the eyes of the persecuting crowd or through the eyes of Christ? To respond in the first way is idolatry. To respond in the second is true worship." So I would argue that the Book of Mormon certainly has a place for a nonviolent pacifist reading. I think when we look at it on the macro level, there's not a lot of support for defensive war in the sense that it never works. It never gives them lasting peace. And no matter how justified they feel they are, it doesn't work. And the only thing we find that works in the Book of Mormon is the alternate view, the one that the sons of Mosiah gives, the ones that Nephi Lehi gives, the one that Jesus of Nazareth gives us, the one that unfortunately the Nephites and Lamanites chose not to follow, and that ended in their destruction. And so that's sort of my reading of the Book of Mormon, and we're going to, I guess, open it up for questions. And so...
free will was 75% to 80% of what he said. It was heartfelt, it was idealistic. I knew the Iraq War was a mistake from the beginning. Chalabi, we used people who were wanted in Jordan for fraud. He was their Bernie Madoff. And Bush relied on him. Bush's dad didn't finish the first Iraq War, so Bush even wrote that he was avenging what his daddy couldn't finish up in 1991. I do take exception with you on Afghanistan, though. It's too complicated. Leave people in the Bush administration out. We know they're a bunch of crooks. We know they're a bunch of people just wanted oil. But people like Mavis Leno, Jay Leno's wife, people like Sam Nunn, the moderate Democrat from Georgia, they've said that they've worked with Germany, Italy, Spain, France, and they were saying to the Taliban, this Bush guy's a nut. You know, work with us, we'll help you economically, we'll do whatever you want. And the Taliban said, we're playing good cop, bad cop with Bush. We want to destroy the Northern Alliance to the last man. And we also know the Northern Alliance is on the border with Russia. We want to send a message to the Russians, they can't invade us again. So they weren't going to turn over Bin Laden, come hell or high water. I hate to say that, but you know, it was good cop, bad cop. There was no intention behind leadership doing that. And so what we're stuck there is a quagmire. I would get out of Iraq, I would get out of Afghanistan, but I would let the Russians and maybe the Indians. India's going to be the main one that's hurt by this because the Taliban is working with Pakistan intelligence. We know that. We've wasted $15 billion a year, or $15 billion since 2000. And Pakistan is now helping the Taliban. We found these new memos on WikiLeaks. We knew that before, to be honest. And so it's going to be India and Russia to take the hit. They're going to have to find a way to find a common bond, go in and solve the job that we couldn't do. So as much as I hate war, I say turn it over to Russia and India. People that know what they're doing. Russia has slaughtered Chechnya. I think it's the worst war crime since Hitler, and nobody even talks about it.
Yeah.
Yet the Russians are eager for some more war. They want to mix it up with some more Muslims. Let Russia get into Afghanistan. We should have been neutral in their fight with them back in 79. So just talking about, one more thing I wanted to mention. I want you to comment on, both of you. I just turned 50. My brother's in his 60s. He was at BYU in the mid to late 60s. And he said it was amazing that nobody protested Vietnam. That when LBJ and Nixon came, everybody was like, bring a sign, win with honor, don't leave until the job's done. Even Notre Dame and University of Indiana, Midwestern things, Johnson and Nixon were booed when they went to those universities. At BYU, they're welcome, just win, you're doing great. Why is it that the one religion that had an extermination order put them on by this country, Governor Boggs, and had other trouble with the government? Why are we so pro-war on every single thing from Vietnam to everything before that to everything after that? So comment, I don't give you a whole lot to comment on.
Yeah, I'll try to do the first part, and for the second part, I don't know, maybe actually Boyd, maybe you'd want to comment on that, because I'm not really a scholar of Mormon history, so I just have like ideas, but they're not, I haven't like read enough to really back them up about why Mormons are so pro-war, but it's definitely, you know, disturbing, obviously. But I mean, yeah, there's the situation in Afghanistan is really tricky, because obviously the Taliban aren't good guys, and so, you know, as in most wars, I feel like Afghan civilians, just like this is largely the case with Iraqi civilians, they're getting caught between different armed groups that are all bad. Like in Iraq, you had so many different armed groups. You had the U.S. military, you had Al-Qaeda, you had the Mahdi army, you had the Badr Brigades, you had Iranian intelligence, you had, there's just so many groups. You had the nationalist Sunni resistance groups. And, you know, Iraqi civilians basically are the ones that suffered. And it's largely that way, I think, in Afghanistan as well, because the United States, even though we're supposedly, you know, good about women's rights and things like this, the warlords that we're supporting, because we didn't want to have a heavy troop presence there, we were mostly focused on preparing to go invade Iraq, and also supposedly didn't want to make the same mistakes that the Russians did by having this really heavy footprint of an occupation in Afghanistan. So they basically outsourced the war to the Northern Alliance. And the Northern Alliance warlords, I mean, they're some of the worst human rights abusers that you can come across in the world. And they did things to women that are just unspeakable, you know, just like the Taliban does. And so it is... They're not quite as bad, but... there's a guy named Abdurrasul Sayyid. I don't know, there's, you know, a lot of stories. I mean, they were raping, pillaging, all kinds of crazy things.
They just don't people down for not wearing the burqa. That's a big difference.
Right. So, I mean, is the Taliban worse? Yeah, but it's, at any rate, the biggest thing is, like, the problem of Afghanistan is that there's been war there for, you know, such a long time.
And I didn't get a chance to talk about this earlier. I just didn't mention it because due to time, but I'll mention it really quick. Is that the problems that are in Afghanistan now are largely a result of U.S. intervention there. In the late 70s, there was a communist government in Afghanistan. The Russians hadn't invaded yet, and the U.S. deliberately started giving covert aid to the Mujahideen to fight against the Soviet-backed Afghan communist government, specifically in the hopes that doing so would destabilize the Afghan communist government and induce the Soviets to invade. And the reason the U.S. wanted to do that is we thought, well, if we can, you know, start a proxy war in Afghanistan, force the Soviets to invade, then that'll basically drain their economic resources, and that'll help us win the Cold War. And so, I don't know how to say this guy's name, but Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was in the Carter administration at the time, he openly says it was one of the best things we ever did. It brought the Soviets down because it was their Vietnam, basically. And so that's what started this cycle of warfare. It was not necessary on the part of the U.S. They didn't care about the lives of Afghans. They said, hey, let's start a war there. That's going to benefit us and U.S. foreign policy. They started giving money to the Mujahideen, and those groups are the ones who became Northern Alliance warlords, but also who became Al-Qaeda and then later the Taliban. And so those years in the early 80s with all that U.S. support, that's when the Mujahideen were going around and started burning schools for the first time. The reason they did that is because they considered schools like hotbeds of atheism, because, you know, the communist doctrines were being taught, including things about equality for women, and, you know. So that's when schools started being burned. That's when the rights of women just went down the tubes with all that backing for, you know, about that 10 years that the U.S. was supporting the Mujahideen. And then when the Soviets, after the Soviets invaded and finally withdrew, all those warlords who were fighting against the Soviets with our help plunged the country into a civil war that was just terrible. That's why people actually welcomed the Taliban when they first came, is because the warlords had been so bad during that time. At any rate, the lesson I draw from U.S. involvement in Afghanistan is that time and time again, it's been our preference to use violence when it's not necessary, and Afghan civilians for 30 years now have borne the brunt of the really terrible policy decisions that the U.S. has made, even though, yeah, they might have been good for our foreign policy or our benefits, but it was terrible for Afghans.
Do we give a green light to the Russians and let them take care of it now if we get out?
Yeah, I don't know exactly what to do. But sorry, maybe Boyd can comment on the last part if there's time about why Mormons are so pro-war. Maybe you don't even want to do it. I'm sorry.
Well, especially
the
people
you
met, so pro-Vietnam or pro-Russia.
I don't know. Does this one work at all? No? At all?
I'll be brief. I agree with you. I think BYU has been traditionally very conservative. However, there has been consistently a kind of small underground. A friend of mine named Gordon Thomason actually passed out some handouts that were produced by the Young Democrats at BYU, in which Hugh Nibley gave them permission to reproduce a talk called Brigham Young on War. Hugh Nibley actually told him to pass these out, and he was arrested. This was at a rally. Right after, there was a film that came out called No Substitute for Victory that was produced, kind of a propaganda piece for Vietnam, starring John Wayne and Ezra Taft Benson. And when it premiered at BYU, the pages of the Daily Herald announced it, and there was a huge amount of support, a huge turnout. The day after that, Hugh Nibley had an article in the paper called A Substitute for Victory, in which he decried that kind of pro-war attitude and called on us to turn away from war. There was not a universal attitude about this issue. In fact, the church actually fought to maintain conscientious objector status for Mormons. It was believed that Mormons couldn't have it, and the church fought for that. I'm not sure how far back it goes, but J. Reuben Clark was very much anti-internationalism, and so he was very fond of the idea of maintaining that conscientious objector status. And again, there was a small group at BYU who were helping potential Vietnam vets learn how to get conscientious objector status. So it's not a complete universal. There is a kind of small underground, and so I think that needs to be kind of remembered in the historical record.
I was there in the late 60s.
Oh,
and I made my protest going in Ellersborg meetings. I wrote a 50-page paper in my second English class protesting the Vietnam War and its history and why we should have never been in there in the first place. And my first comment is for you. While these are very tragic, you talk about the bombing of the wedding parties and these mistaken killings and things like that as perpetuating the war. Yet during World War II, we firebombed Dresden, leveled Berlin, firebombed Tokyo, and dropped the atomic bombs on Nagasaki and Hiroshima. Those two countries are now our allies. They're very productive in the world. And our ally during that war, Russia, became our greatest enemy. So I'm not so sure that works. And my opinion, once you get in a war, You should in the first place, but once you're in, you've got to crush the enemy or get out. Now, this is for both of you. I'm going to state some facts and then pose a question. 50% of the Muslim males are illiterate. 66% of the females are illiterate. In about 1962, there were 168 of these, I can't remember what they called these schools, where imams taught, with about 10,000 students. Now in Pakistan, there's 15,000 of them and about a million students. The weapon of choice in this war should be education, I think. We're missing the boat there, and we're never going to defeat them militarily.
Yeah, I don't have... comment on that. I agree with you, and I think that was the point I was trying to make is from the Book of Mormon that I gather is that until you change the way that your enemies see the world and understand it, you're never going to have lasting peace. And so education, obviously, in this situation is one. That's why I think people like Greg Mortensen from Three Cups of Tea are doing remarkable work that is moving towards changing the dialogue and changing the discussion, which will have probably, in my mind, more lasting effect on peace than any bomb ever could.
I think regarding the first issue of like bombings during World War II, you know, there's a couple options. Like you mentioned, I mean, one way to end wars is just to murder as many people as you can. That's basically what we did in Vietnam. I mean, estimates are between 1 and 3 million Vietnamese. And I mean, but we did destroy their country and made an example of it to the rest of the world that they. Other countries better not mess with us because we devastated Vietnam. But you're right, we might be able to win wars. Maybe World War II is a better example by firebombing and murdering women and children. But if the war isn't worth fighting to begin with, why not just withdraw and leave Afghans?
You either get out or you press the enemy. You can't push the foot around. All that does is perpetuate the agony.
But I would say we should get out rather than crush them.
Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld. Bush, Cheney, and Rumsfeld really should be on either incompetence or war crimes. We have Bin Laden trapped in Tora Bora. Instead of bombing him and taking out he and his 2,000 fighters, we contracted it out with the North Alliance. They were bribed. They let Bin Laden get to Pakistan. Bush ought to be brought into war crimes for that. We had the chance. We had the satellite. Everything to get
it. We could have, yeah.
Could have been the whole war in 1 month and over.
Very much.
Go ahead, Marshall.
Okay, I was just wondering the idea of the defensive wars being generally justified and the offensive wars you don't entirely unjustify according to the Book of Mormon. In your studies or in your research for this, was there any indication as to whether a war overseas could be a defensive war? It almost always seems to me that geography might be a good indication that if you're fighting on your own soil, it's defensive. If you're fighting on someone else's soil, it's offensive. Did you get any feeling for that?
Well, I mean, if you're going to take the Book of Mormon as an example, and there's always a question of how well you can apply this ancient text to the modern world, I mean, certainly they make it clear that it always has to be on your own land. In fact, it's when they decide to go into foreign lands that Mormon says they did everything that was forbidden them by Jesus Christ, namely going into foreign lands, and vengeance is mine, thus saith the Lord. he sort of felt that that was a breaking point that meant the end of Nephite civilization. From there on, it was just downhill. So if you're going to use the Book of Mormon as an example, it certainly has that kind of break you can do from foreign lands to your own.
I just want to make a statement on example of defensive versus offensive. That a good example is the Korean War. The defensive is when we decided to cross the 38th parallel and we brought the Chinese in and we got shoved back. We got beaten in that war. We stopped the 38th parallel and probably been over.
Let me make one statement. Let me make one. Here's what I'm going to do real quick. I just want to read something to you guys, and I think this illustrates what my problem is with defensive war. I'm going to read this quote, and this was in an interview. You can find this in a New Yorker article with the number 2 Al-Qaeda. How do you do it, Will?
Zawahiri.
I apologize. And they asked him, are there other ways to achieve your objectives of jihad without killing people? And he said, if a criminal were to storm into your house, attack your family and kill them, steal your property, burn down your house, and then turns to attack the homes of your neighbors, will you treat him tolerantly so that you will not become a gang whose only concern is revenge? I have a few other quotes from him. And what's interesting, when you read their quotes, they're almost always couched in defensive war language. The very type of language that we see used on our side. And so when you look at history, and I think Will mentioned this, almost every nation uses defensive war language. They always describe their side as being defensive. That's why we have a defense department as opposed to a war department.
It's changed, actually.
Did they change it recently? Yeah.
No, it used to be a war department.
All right, there you go. Well, yeah, okay, yeah, they changed defense to cover that up, yes. And so, you know, even the quote-unquote evil bad guys, they frame it as defensive war. They see themselves as defense. And so there's a real problem, at least with me, with defensive war. You know, whether it's the amount of intelligence we have, I think it's become pretty clear that we are lied to. We didn't even have the full intelligence, whether it's WikiLeaks revealing things or whether it's just simply what we've learned from other sources. How do we decide when a war is defensive, in particularly our modern situation where there's so much intelligence lacking? How do we decide when we look at, you know, September 11th didn't happen in a vacuum. There's 10, 15, 20 years preceding that where tons of things could have been done to prevent it. And so these wars that we call defensive wars, we call them defensive war because we go, oh, now it's defensive, when there was 15, 20 years before where we could have changed the tide and we could have had peace, but instead we let things keep marching inevitably towards war.
And just a comment on that, Marshall. Yeah, I think that is a really good indicator. You know, what are you doing in Iraq? What are you doing in Afghanistan? The Bush people would say, well, in the era of weapons of mass destruction, you can't wait. You know, you can't just try to defend the homeland because what if a terrorist gets, you know, a weapon of mass destruction? Millions of Americans could die. But, you know, these are basically just fantasy scenarios. And we definitely know the result of fighting these wars in other lands, which is you just make people more angry. Even the CIA, National Intelligence Estimate from 2007 basically concluded that because of the Iraq War, because of Abu Ghraib, because of Guantanamo, all these things we've done to torture and kill Muslims in their own countries has led to more and more terrorist attacks on the United States. So even though the Bush people, I guess maybe it's reasonable to be worried about weapons of mass destruction being passed to terrorists, and, you know, obviously you'd want to worry about that, but by taking these offensive actions in other people's countries, you're just, you know, making the problem even worse and making it even more likely that, you know, terrorists will be motivated or want to use weapons of mass destruction somehow, even though I don't think it's that feasible, but their motivation just goes up. And the number of their supporters who will help them will go up. So, sorry.
Real quick comment, and then we...
Okay. I was just going to say, we talk a lot about statistics, but human beings aren't statistics, and the Book of Mormon perspective on this is also a Christian perspective. And my feeling is, if you live too far away from someone to understand their side of the story, then they're too far away for you to fight a war with them. The real point of this, I think, is what Josh is talking about, that we need to be better readers of other people's stories, and that we need to be better readers of our own scriptures, because if we're not, then we fight wars with people, and we can't understand. I think that the economics and the statistics are important, but the thing that's important to me is how would I feel if somebody bombed the wedding party of my family and killed all of my brothers and sisters, like, how would I feel about that? And I think that's honestly, like, the number one thing that we have to remember in all this. And I was going to ask a question, but I guess I'll make it a comment. I appreciate both of you because I think you're really good readers. And most people, when they start reading the scriptures, are like, man, it came to pass that we did terrible things to other people and we were justified. Amen. And, like, but I love how you read the Book of Mormon because you're a good reader. And I think it's a call for Mormons and religious people of all types to be better readers of their own scriptures and say, even if this is the story, what's the point in this entire body of scriptures? The point is that this was a tragedy. An entire civilization was destroyed by hatred because someone chose to write a story from their perspective alone. So I just appreciate your reading.
Great way to end it.